You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new data shows there's a record percentage of 4-3 rulings from Wisconsin's Supreme Court in its term so far. We'll talk to the researcher behind the data about what it tells us about the state's highest court. Now, the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its second televised public hearing this morning, which we aired live here on the Ideas Network. The commission provided testimony from Trump campaign officials and attorneys, along with former Attorney General Bill Barr, who said the former president was told he lost the 2020 election and that his claims of voter fraud were unfounded. The lawmakers on the committee said they intend to use this evidence to help show the connection between Trump and the storming of the Capitol. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to this morning's public hearing? What stood out to you? What questions do you have about what they presented, why they did it? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's currently editor of the Election Law Journal and is affiliated with the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Rob.
What stood out most to you at today's hearings?
Well, a couple of things. One is the committee seems to be laying the groundwork here for a criminal indictment, because one of the key things you have to do with a criminal indictment is to prove intent. And so all of the testimony we heard today from the Republican campaign officials, from Ben Ginsburg, one of the leading election law attorneys that litigates on behalf of Republicans, they all said that Trump knew after the election, his campaign people, the attorney general, were telling him, you lost the election. Yet he persisted in the big lie of trying to claim the election was stolen. And so if you have all of these people who are close to the president, meeting with the president after the election, you know, telling him this is not true, this there is no factual basis for the claims that are being made that the election is being stolen, that lays the groundwork then for saying, well, Trump knew that this wasn't the case, yet he still told his supporters to, you know, to try to stop the counting of the electoral vote. So I think that's the main takeaway from today. Then there was a tantalizing thing at the very end where they threw out for the first time what could be another potential something that could bring a criminal indictment, which is misuse of campaign funds. So this, you know, $250 million that was raised, you know, after the election for the Election Defense Fund, and you had Trump campaign officials saying the Election Defense Fund really wasn't a thing and that the money was just funneled to the Save America PAC, and a very small portion of that $250 million was actually spent on legal fees. And some of this was reported at the time, but this really is something that the committee has not focused on so far, and they kind of just threw it out there at the end and really didn't develop it. So maybe that's something they're planning to come back to in the future.
Well, let's take each of those in turn. Let's start with former Attorney General Bill Barr. The latest testimony that they shared was in a lot of ways the center point of today's hearings. Here's a portion of the video the committee played this morning.
I was somewhat demoralized because I thought, boy, if he really believes this stuff, he has, you know, lost contact he's become detached from reality. On the other hand, you know, when I went into this and would, you know, tell him how crazy some of these allegations were, there was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were.
How significant is it that this is coming from President Trump's choice of attorney general to replace one he was dissatisfied with, who had been seen, I think, as a strong Trump loyalist up to this point?
Well, right. And that was, I think, a really significant point about today, is that everybody who testified today were Republicans. So one thing you often hear from Trump and his supporters, this is a partisan witch hunt. Well, these were all Republicans talking, including, as you say, the former attorney general, who was a very strong Trump supporter throughout his presidency. If you think back to the Mueller report, you know, Democrats were, you know, chastising Barr at the time for really kind of not quite, you know, throwing it under the rug, but definitely downplaying the significance of that Mueller report in a way that affected, I think, how the public interpreted that. So, you know, you could say that Barr helped save his presidency, you know, during that first impeachment investigation and impeachment, yet Barr, by the end, had clearly decided that Trump had lost touch with reality. He kept on persisting with the claim the election was stolen, and Barr then resigns, of course, in mid-December because he was just fed up with how this was going.
You mentioned that this is being set up in a way as a prosecutorial laying out of facts here. Now, this committee can't prosecute. So who is the audience for something like that? Who would look at these false election claims and potentially run with that?
Well, Merrick Garland clearly is the main focus here for the committee, that he's the one in the Department of Justice that would have to eventually, bring an indictment if that were to happen. And Garland, as has been kind of frustrating, I think, to some Democrats, especially on the committee, is a very cautious person, and he would not proceed with any kind of legal action against the former president unless he was quite sure that he had a case that could be won. And so that's what the committee, I think, is trying to do right now, is to lay out that groundwork for him and say, look, we think we have the evidence to go ahead with an indictment. Here, go do it.
And we don't often see indictments from the Justice Department of former presidents. Like Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford had pardoned him before it could get to that point after the Watergate resignation. There's a pretty high, no pun on Bill Barr's name, there's a pretty high bar here, right?
Right, no, for sure. And I think it seems unlikely to me, given what we know about Merrick Garland, that he will go ahead just because it is so unprecedented, and that I think that especially with the difficulty of establishing intent, that you have to prove to a jury that the President Trump really thought that he knew that he had lost the election, he had persisted with all these claims, and that's tough to do. And even Bill Barr in his testimony that wasn't played in your clip, but later on in the testimony, he says, yeah, it's possible he still believed this. And, to Barr, this was crazy. And in fact, the campaign manager for Donald Trump, talked about how, they had sort of divided people up into team normal and team crazy. That's what, Trump's campaign advisor said, I was glad to be included in team normal, not team crazy. And so people on the inside saw these claims as clearly wrong. But to be able to prove that Trump really knew that what he was saying was false, that's hard to do.
Talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, looking at the second day of public hearings in the House January 6th Commission. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, outside of the legal side of things, the false claims about election fraud in 2020 are a big issue in the midterm elections in 2022. Some of the people who generated those claims are running for, governor of Pennsylvania, for example, where they might have influence over what happens with election outcomes there. A lot of people at the January 6th protests are now running for office in Wisconsin and elsewhere. What does it mean politically to have these Trump insiders, his campaign manager, lawyers, his attorney general, saying we knew from the start that these claims were false? We were telling the president that they were false, even as he kept claiming them after we told him they were false.
Well, one would hope this would start to bring more pressure on the people who can continue to deny the truth about the election, and to then maybe give some more leeway to Republicans who would like to be able to distance themselves from Trump and to move on from the election deniers and to focus on the issues that the voters care about for the midterm elections. And so with all of this testimony today, that might be able to create more space for some Republicans who do want to break with President Trump. But that's going to be tough for some of them to do, clearly.
And then flipping that around, some Republicans are saying, hey, Democrats, you're wasting your time with this stuff. Year and a half ago, this is old news. Voters don't care about this anymore. Do you think that it's worth in the House, especially if no indictments come out of this, do you think it's worth reviewing this in the way that the House is doing?
Oh, I think it's absolutely essential to keep on trying to convince the public of what happened on January 6th really was an attempted coup, and that this was something that remains a threat to democracy as long as people don't recognize what happened. Because if you don't hold the people accountable who perpetrated the big lie, you open the door for this happening again in the future. And especially, I think a really critical thing that needs to happen, you know, before the midterms is to revise the Electoral Count Act, which is something there is a bipartisan group of senators right now. They're trying to work on a compromise to fix that law that opened the door for all of the potential mischief on the night of the counting the electoral votes, because the law is poorly worded and ambiguous, and it needs to be clarified that, for example, the vice president only duty is to open the ballots and count the votes the way that Vice President Pence decided that that was his role. But there were people like, you know, Eastman, the attorney that worked with the president to try to have the alternative interpretation of how the electoral count would proceed, was, you know, based on this other reading of that law, which I think, again, needs to be fixed. So that is another thing on the agenda here. The purpose of these hearings is to try to make everyone recognize this wasn't just a one-off. This is a potential threat to our democracy in the future.
We're recapping day two of the January 6th public hearings with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Were you surprised by the testimony from Trump campaign officials and lawyers and cabinet members in one case? Do you think this testimony should end other efforts to overturn the 2020 election? Does it change how you view election integrity in the United States? Call in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon. With us today, looking at the latest testimony from the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and the events leading up to it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions to what you've been seeing and hearing. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hi, Rob. Love your show.
Thanks.
You know that. So I just wanted to, this really could be considered a question, but I'm wondering if anyone thinks the January 6th committee will present as evidence the pattern of behavior of Donald Trump actually way back, I think it was in 14 when he was doing the Republican primary, when he said, if I lose this, I'll show you how the system's rigged.
Paul,
and that was kind of, I think it's interesting, that sort of timeline there.
Paul, thanks for the call. David, Paul referring to then candidate Donald Trump in 2016, saying if he lost, it was going to be because of fraud. When he lost the Iowa caucus to Ted Cruz, he claimed there was fraud there too. Is that relevant, do you think, as a pattern of claims?
Well, I think, yeah, Paul's onto something here, and this is something that the committee has talked about and looked into, and I imagine this will be part of their overall case, is that this is something that has been, you know, a consistent message from Trump in 2016, not only when he lost Iowa, but remember after he beat Hillary Clinton, he was claiming there was fraud, you know, because he was upset that he lost a popular vote. So he was claiming there were all these, you know, dead people voting and illegal, you know, non-citizens voting and everything, even in 2016 when he won. And he certainly laid the groundwork in 2020, starting very early on. In March, April of 2020, he was saying the only way I can lose in the fall, when he was behind in the polls, of course, you know, would be if the election was stolen. And that was repeated, you know, dozens of times then over the course of the election. So this is something that was part of the mindset of Trump for sure, is that he's trying to make everyone believe it's stolen, you know, to then be able to make the claim, like on election night when he claims victory, even when we had testimony today from his campaign manager and other campaign people, you know, telling him not to do that because the votes were still being counted. And it was, you know, predicted in many of these states that would eventually go for Joe Biden, that Biden was going to carry those states. But Trump went ahead and declared victory anyway on election night.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Joe joins us now, calling from on the road. Joe, hi.
Hello, how are you gentlemen doing? Thank you for this program. I just want to mention something about, you know, it's very difficult to prove seditious conspiracy in court. But Liz Cheney, a while back, not at these hearings, but at the recent hearings, but she said something like, it is a felony by action or inaction to impede the workings of Congress. And for 3 hours, Trump sat there and did nothing. That, to me, would seem to be very easy to prove in court, and that should be Mr. Garland's focus, because you don't have to prove intent. All you got to prove is that he was sitting on his fat derriere and did nothing for 3 hours. That's a felony. Convict him of that.
Joe, thanks for the call. David, I think the hours that Joe is referring to there are likely to be the subject of some of the future hearings.
That's right. We didn't have testimony on that today, but Joe's absolutely right. That's going to be a crucial part of the testimony coming up. Right now, they're in that phase of, again, laying the groundwork for, you know, what was Trump's state of mind, you know, right after the election. You know, did he know what he was saying was false? And today we heard testimony from his campaign manager, from Bill Barr, all these other people who were telling him, you know, on election night and for the next, you know, month and a half, that yes, you lost this election. And but the idea about what did Trump do after the assault on the Capitol had started, and where he didn't forcefully try to stop that from progressing, that could be itself another criminal act. And we will hear more about that in the subsequent hearings.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Talking to David Cannon about the public hearings today, day two of the public part of the hearings of the January 6th committee in the U.S. House. Back to your calls now. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Hey. One of my favorite authors had a character who talked about someone who had unassailable ignorance, and I think that's what we're looking at. If anything, we're talking about the insanity defense. He's presented over and over with a variety of facts which say the evidence that you're getting is false, and yet he ignores it. Now, is that to me, that's willful ignorance, but not necessarily culpable. I mean, he is psychologically unable to accept the fact, accept these facts as true.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. I had exactly that same thought process today that this all just, you know, went through. That, you know, either way you take this, Trump is not qualified to be president of the United States, because either, as Bill Barr put it, he's detached from reality, and that's we you played the clip earlier where Bill Barr, you know, says that he was really disturbed by the fact that they were telling Trump this over and over again, and he just couldn't accept it. So either it was criminal intent because he knew what he was saying was false and he was just being strategic about it, then obviously then that he's not qualified to be president because he, you know, should be in jail. Second would be if he really did believe it, but then he's detached from reality and should not be president because he can't come to grips with the facts in front of him.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Bill now in Superior. Bill, hello.
Hi, quick question. We're having this hearing about the riots at the Capitol. When are we going to have a hearing, do you think, on the riots and the looting that Antifa and BLM were in front of, that was endorsed and supported by many Congress people and senators on the left when all that happened? When are we going to have that hearing?
Bill, thanks for the call. David, this is, I think people often try to make an equivalence between the two. What do you think?
Well, I mean, everyone, when this comes up, I mean, everyone always, you know, points out that the violence that happened at some of the rallies in support of George Floyd and trying to, you know, bring some focus on the criminal justice system in this country, you know, will, you know, always say that the violence that happened in those cases is obviously something that's deplorable and should not have happened. And we have had a lot of discussion about the various incidents, you know, in cities around the country. But, you know, this is something quite different. It's a very different category than a threat to our democracy, that the foundation of our country always has been the peaceful transition of power from one political party to the other political party when they lose an election. If we lose that basis for democracy, we no longer will be a country. And so the stakes are so much higher for this, and this is why I think this is so important to, you know, keep our focus on this. And you know, Bill is right to, you know, raise concerns about, you know, other incidents that happened in the past, and those have been discussed and are receiving attention both at the local level, state level, and nationally as well. But it really is a very separate issue that's not sort of directly relevant for the discussion today.
Bill, thanks for the call. David, I want to bring back a phrase you used earlier in the discussion, attempted coup. And some people probably nodded along when they heard that. Some might be like, wait, what? Do you think it's fair to describe what happened leading up to and including January 6th as an attempted coup?
Well, that I was using that phrase because that was Benny Thompson, the chair of the committee's phrase. That's how he described it on Thursday, the opening night of the hearings. He described it in that language of the attempted coup, and that's what the committee is trying to now prove, that this was something that was a concerted effort to stop that peaceful transition of power from one party to the other.
As just our last minute, what are you watching for in the remaining hearings?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that will get more attention. One is, you know, what happened after the start of the assault on the Capitol, and what were the actions, you know, of the president? What was his mindset at the time? We did have a couple of brief mentions of that in the opening night of the hearings, where there was a conversation that Trump has said he didn't have, where he said that maybe the supporters are right when it comes to Mike Pence, you know, maybe that they should hang Mike Pence. And he didn't use exactly the phrase hang Mike Pence, but it was clear that he was being supportive of the protest of the people who were in the Capitol at the time, and when Mike Pence was, you know, really in danger. So I think there'll be more discussion of that, of what were his actions, what was his mindset, you know, on January 6th itself. Whereas right now it's been, again, more the sort of lead up to that.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's currently editor of the Election Law Journal, and he's affiliated with the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. He joined us today to check in on the latest testimony presented by the House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. We'll be airing the rest of those when they resume later this week here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. And coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, get more analysis of the ongoing public hearings in Congress with Kate Archer-Kent and her guest. Join in with your thoughts tomorrow morning at 7:30. On Food Friday last week, we invited you to share your advice for other cooks and got lots of great suggestions. We also got an email from Beth in Menominee, who has advice about using recipes from cookbooks and other sources. Beth writes, to start, my cookbook collection is growing. I blame you and your show. If I haven't bought them, they're on the list. I've gotten so many good ones, they read like a novel to me. Also have too many recipes saved to try. Beth's suggestion is for new cooks. Beth says, when you try a new recipe, follow it exactly. If there's something you absolutely don't like, then do change that. The recipes usually are made to give you good results. If you don't like it as given the first time, then feel free to make any changes to suit your taste and make notes. Beth, good advice. I especially follow that when I'm trying a new style of cooking, maybe a new kind of ethnic food from around the world, a new ingredient or whatever. I try to stay close to the letter. Other than that, I tend to play it pretty fast and loose. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the professional golf world is facing some structural and moral dilemmas as PGA players seek bigger payouts from a Saudi-backed tournament. A Wisconsin golf writer tells us what's been going on in the sport. Now, almost half of the cases decided by the state Supreme Court so far this term have split 4-3. It's according to new data from Marquette University. The research says justices are ruling 4-3 more often this term than at any point in more than 7 decades. Alan Ball analyzed that data for ScouStats.com. That's a blog that crunches numbers about cases and decisions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He's a professor of history at Marquette University. Alan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
How does this 4-3 decision split compare with years past?
Well, it's much higher, as you said. In fact, as a result of the most recent decision that was filed, it's now exactly half of all the decisions this term. There were 30 decisions filed this term, and 15 of them have been 4-3, which is much higher than any of the previous years. The next highest year was the previous year, 2021, for 37%, and that was a result of some of the factors I imagine that we'll be talking about today. The other surprising thing was that it, with a court that's usually regarded as a conservative court, that the liberal justices have been in the majority of these 4-3 decisions much more often than the justices who are regarded as the most conservative, Justices Rogan, Sack, and Ziegler, and Rebecca Bradley. Two very big surprises.
Before we dig into the swing vote on these, what is it about these narrow decisions? Why are they so common this last couple of years?
Well, I'd say that it's because you have two groups of three justices each, the three liberals, Ann Walsh Bradley, Dalit, and Kurowski on the one hand, and Rogan, Sack, Ziegler, and Rebecca Bradley on the other, that almost always vote together in these decisions. So you've got automatically or almost automatically three on one side and three on the other side, and meaning that there, it's going to be a 4-3 decision, and the crucial player as a result is Justice Hagedorn, who has been in the majority almost always in these 13 out of 15 of the 4-3 decisions. He's been in the majority. And so, in effect, you're not going to win unless you get Hagedorn's vote. And as I said, one of the most surprising things is that he has sided more often with the liberals this time, this term, so far anyway, than he has with the conservatives.
And surprising because he was a candidate. We have, these are nonpartisan offices. You don't run with an R or D, but all the candidates are backed by Republicans or Democrats. He had support from Republicans in his campaign.
Yes, well, he was Governor Walker's legal counsel. Mm-hmm. So I would never have predicted this when he was running for the Supreme Court.
Now, something struck me looking at your charts on this. We've got this jump in 4-3 rulings. At the other end, there's a lot of unanimous rulings. There's just not a lot of ground between those. So what, are a bunch of the issues, I guess, gimmies? No matter where you're coming from on the court, you're going to join a unanimous decision on it?
Well, the percentage of unanimous decisions is currently right now is 40%, which isn't unusual. There have been recent years where it's been at least 40, if not higher. It's relatively high, but not unusual. The biggest change has been in that there are very, very few 6-1 and 5-2 decisions, far fewer than in any of the other years that I've looked at. And that reflects the fact that, as I mentioned, that you have three justices on the liberal side and three on the conservative side that almost always vote together. If it's a gimme, as you say, then they're all going to vote together. But it's much, much rarer that you only have one or two in the minority.
We've got a state Supreme Court election race next year, an open seat. One of the conservative justices stepping down is the current plan anyway. This narrow split, I imagine, is going to put a lot of focus on this election.
Oh, yes. This will be a tremendously consequential election, depending on what happens, of course. If, say, Justice Rogan's Act is replaced with someone who's regarded as a liberal, then we would have on the court something that we've never had before in all of the decades that I've been serving, and that is that you would have four liberals. And that, of course, could result in very different decisions on provocative cases, say gerrymandering or other things, than we've had in the past. If Justice Rogan's Act is replaced with someone who's a conservative, then we'd have pretty much what we have right now, where Justice Hagedorn would be the crucial vote. If Justice Rogan's Act is replaced with a liberal, however, Justice Hagedorn's role would become much less significant because the liberals could win without him. They would have Ann Walsh Bradley, Dalit, Kurowski, and whoever the new liberal was. And so Justice Hagedorn would be in a similar position to what he was in back in 2019-20 when Justice Kelly was still on the court, and the conservatives could win without Hagedorn. And so he was much less often crucial and much less often in the 4-3 majorities. Back then, the conservatives didn't need him in 2019-20 with Kelly. And if Rogan's Act is replaced with a liberal, then now the liberals wouldn't need him.
This is we've done the number crunching here. Can you remind people why it's important to watch these kind of trends in the state Supreme Court and what kind of things are at stake in the state?
Well, it's extremely important because so many very provocative issues come before the court. Say, for instance, in the recent year, measures pertaining to how COVID should be dealt with or should not be dealt with, and especially challenges to the election, that there have been a large number of original action petitions filed where some actor, some group is asking the court to take a case immediately and not let it go through the lower courts, generally challenging the election. And the court can make crucial decisions that affect everybody's life, whether, say, we accept the election as valid. For instance, last year there were an unprecedentedly large number of original action petitions filed challenging the election, and the court generally rejected them. And here, too, in the eight cases where we know how the justices voted, we only know if they filed a dissent or a concurrence or something, then we know how they voted. In the eight cases where we know how they voted, the conservative justices wanted to accept cases that challenged the election, much along the lines, say, that former Justice Gableman is trying to do now, and Hagedorn sided with the liberals in refusing to take those cases. If, say, Dan Kelly had not lost to Kurowski and had still been on the court, then we might have had four justices agreeing to take these challenges to the elections. And, of course, the landscape politically could have been quite different. So, yes, there's tremendous importance resting on the outcome of these Supreme Court elections.
Alan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Alan Ball, professor of history at Marquette University, with us today to talk about his new data showing a record percentage of 4-3 rulings from Wisconsin's Supreme Court so far in the court's current term. He wrote about those numbers on his blog, SCOW Stats. That's SCOWstats.com. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about lessons learned on a family camping trip.
Taking the kids camping usually sounds like a great idea, until it's not. Author B.J. Hollers brings us a story about the trials and triumphs of the family camping trip.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. With those famous words, Charles Dickens opened his classic novel, which, if you read no further, might very well be a book about camping. Ah, camping, the foolhardiest of summer traditions. The chance to dust off the tent, unfurl the sleeping bags, and pretend that you enjoy the outdoors. And all the better if you actually do. And we did, at least for a little while, as my children and I pulled into our campsite at Coon Fork Campground 30 miles east of Eau Claire. Standing at the edge of our site, we peered out at the glistening 62-acre lake, while overhead the birds welcomed us with song. My 8-year-old son shimmied beneath my left arm, my 6-year-old daughter took refuge beneath my right. Together, we all inhaled a gallon-sized breath of cool Wisconsin air. It was the best of times, indeed. Right up until the storm struck a few hours later, sending us speeding back to the comforts of our home. Warm beds never felt so good. Returning to our site the following morning, I was relieved to find that the weather gods had taken pity on us. Our tent had not become a houseboat as I'd feared, merely a waterbed. No matter, it was nothing 10 absorbent towels couldn't fix. Our return to Coon Fork the morning following the storm came with an added challenge. Our 9-month-old baby, who was destined to enjoy her first day of camping while my wife went off to work. Perhaps enjoy is too strong a word. Maybe endure is more accurate. Which she did, suffering little more than a forehead scrape after a topple from the cooler while Daddy extinguished an unplanned cook stove fire that had scorched our lunch. Best of times, indeed. When my wife and the puppy pulled into our campsite at day's end, she witnessed a scene pulled not from the pages of Dickens, but William Golding's Lord of the Flies. We were scraped, sunburned, hungry, tired, and trapped in a soggy tent. "How's it going?" she asked. The baby wailed. Sometime after midnight, I woke to the sound of my wife searching frantically in the dark for a diaper. We searched by cell phone glow as the baby's discomfort grew. I think one's in the van, my wife whispered. Untangling myself from my sleeping bag, I high-stepped over the snoozing puppy, tripped on the lip of the tent, had a run-in with some overly confident raccoons, and at last retrieved the diaper as directed. Then I reversed course, past those raccoons, over the tent lip, and atop the snoozing puppy. Proudly, I handed the diaper to my wife. "And the wipes?" she asked. I sighed. After that second trip to the van, I lingered on the edge of that star-filled lake stretched before me, listening to the nighttime serenade from insects I probably couldn't name. It wasn't the sound, but the stillness that stays with me, a stillness that seemed to neutralize the many mishaps that had compounded throughout the day. I took in one last gallon-sized breath before returning to the tent, where, upon entering, I saw my entire world snoozing safely together, a pile of legs, arms, and stuffed animals all woven together. I reached for my sleeping bag, only to find that the puppy had since commandeered it as his own. Well played, dog. Well played. Finding a spot on the tent's damp floor, I reached for a towel, closed my eyes, and took my place in the pile. It was the best of times, indeed.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, the first Saudi-backed LIV professional golf tournament just wrapped up in London. We'll talk about the concept of sports washing and how this alternative to the PGA Tour is shaking up the sport. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The PGA Tour suspended golfers who elected to also participate in a new, highly lucrative tour that just finished its first event in London. The LIV Tour is funded by the Saudi Arabian government's Public Investment Fund. Its supporters, including American participant Phil Mickelson, have drawn criticism for aligning themselves with them and profiting. What's going on in the golf world right now as a result? How are players dealing with the issues it raises over being seen as endorsing Saudi Arabian leaders and questions of their obligation to already existing tours? Gary D'Amato has covered golf in Wisconsin for several decades, including for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now for Wisconsin.golf. Gary, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Ron. I appreciate it.
Now, I think this is one of those stories, Gary, where there are some people in the golf world who are super focused on it, and some people are just kind of hearing about it, maybe even for the first time. Give us the nuts and bolts. What is this Saudi Arabian-backed tour? Why is it controversial in the golf world?
Well, yeah, that's a big loaded question. It's a new tour that is funded by Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, which is, you know, talking billions of dollars. The PGA Tour can't compete with that kind of money. So what's happening is that this new LIV Tour, of which Greg Norman is the sort of the mouthpiece and sort of the head of the whole tour, they are siphoning off players from the PGA Tour by offering them huge money, just appearance fees. For instance, Phil Mickelson is getting a reported $200 million for this tour, and Dustin Johnson, $150 million. And even and journeymen and players who are in their 40s and really haven't won tournaments in $5 and $10 million to jump to this tour. And then it's offering huge purses on top, $25 million for this past weekend's purse, with $4.75 million winner Charles Schwartzel from South Africa. So we are talking enormous amounts of money. The players, it's 54 hole tournaments instead of 72 PGA Tour. There are no cuts, so you are guaranteed to make money. Last place this past week paid $120,000 to a guy who shot three scores around 80. There's no real competition, and it's just sort of a legend of the PGA Tour between players who are going to this tour and players who are supporting the PGA Tour.
Now, there's a couple points of controversy here. Some golfers have criticized it because it's backed by the Saudi Arabian government. Looking back at the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, other human rights abuses. Is this something that you're hearing people in the golf world talk about, the moral hazard of joining this tour?
So many of the players who are not going over to Saudi Arabia and to the LIV Tour are talking about that subject, and the players who are going are sort of glossing over it, saying, you know, we're here to grow the game of golf. We're, you know, this is Saudi Arabia trying to take steps to improve itself. But a lot of people are saying, seeing right through those and saying they're just going for the money, which is kind of what I happen to believe. Being thrown enormous amounts of money at these guys. And what I say, Rob, is that if Saudi Arabia really wanted to show how progressive it is, it would fund a women's tour and throw that money at women. But of course, I don't think that's going to happen.
Now, this isn't new. This isn't new in the sports world. There have been questions about, you know, American leagues trying to not offend China so that Chinese consumers will still buy, you know, say NBA products or things like that. Olympics, all sorts of politics getting in the way in those. Is this something you've seen in the golf world before, though?
A little bit, because the PGA Tour does do business in China. They are trying to grow the game in China, and we all know that China's, is guilty of many human rights abuses and has a pretty poor record in that department, too. So, and the NBA, is, of course, all in on China. So this has happened, but not to this extent, and not so visible with the top players in the world going over and playing on this tour.
Talking to Gary D'Amato, longtime golf reporter in Wisconsin, now with Wisconsin.golf, talking about this LIV golf tour sponsored with big money by a Saudi Arabian investment fund. Now, Gary, that the Saudi Arabian human rights angle is part of the story here. There's also, I think, a notion, if I'm reading this right, from the PGA of, like, you know, dance with the one that brung you. The PGA Tour is where a lot of these golfers got on the map. That's where they rose through the ranks, and now they're jumping ship for big money. Can you talk about these issues of I guess, loyalty to the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. The PGA Tour is a membership organization that's been around for nearly a century now. And, you know, what the PGA Tour can't offer, the type of money that the Saudis offers, but what they can offer is true competition, for one thing. I think people through right now that the LIV Tour is not really competition. I mean, if you're having a bad day on the golf course and you know that you're still going to make money no matter what you do, I don't grind as hard as you do maybe on the PGA Tour, where it's a true meritocracy and you're paid for your performance. Also, what the PGA Tour can offer is history and legacy. And that's something, obviously, that the LIV Tour has absolutely nothing or none of. Credibility, stability, the PGA Tour has all those things going for it, and right now the LIV Tour does not.
And a recent piece, you heard from Wisconsin golfers, Steve Stricker in particular. What did you hear from him and his thoughts about this whole dust-up?
Yeah, I asked him if he were, you know, Steve's 55 and obviously past his prime, although he still, you know, plays very well. But he's not going to be a winner on the PGA Tour anymore. And I asked him if he was 30 years old and in the top 10 in the world as he was back then, what would he do if the Saudis had him and offered him, you know, 20, 30, 40 million to jump ship? And he said, you know, really, I can say right now I wouldn't go. But he said, I'm saying that now at age 50. What would I do, you know, then? It's impossible to say. He said it would have been a decision. And I will say, Rob, that, you know, it's easy for people to criticize the golf for going over and saying, you know, they're supporting their Saudi effort to sport rush its record and a terrible regime and all these things. But up in their shoes and someone throws, you know, 50 million at you, what would you do? I think it's a harder decision than people would think it is. Talking just about morals and ethics, and would you do it on those grounds? Well, things change. A lot of money is thrown your way, as we've seen.
Now, is there anything that says if I were a high-class golfer, which I am not, but if I were, is there anything to say I couldn't do both? I couldn't keep doing the PGA Tour and take the extra cash to do this Saudi Arabian tournament?
Not, because the PGA Tour clearly sees the LIV Tour as a huge threat. Siphoning players to play in events that are opposite PGA Tour events. So they are losing players to this league. And so the PGA Tour has said it's down his foot and said anyone who not giving you releases to go play in these tournaments, and if you do, you are suspended. So all the players who have gone over there have been suspended. Some of them have resigned their PGA Tour membership, and people say, why would they resign? Well, it's so
this is headed toward litigation. It's going to wind up in the courts at some point. And the players who don't want to get, you know, will probably get dragged into this in court. So they're resigning so they don't have to worry about, you know, being brought into court and being sued.
Gary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gary D'Amato. He covers golf for Wisconsin.golf. He was with us today to talk about how the PGA and the golf world are responding to a new Saudi-backed professional tour that's raising issues of loyalty and morality for golfers. If you have been following this, love to hear from you. If you're in the golf community here in the state, do you have a thought on whether this is good or bad for the game? If you want to see golfers take this Saudi offer up, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Senate negotiators from both parties say they've reached a tentative deal related to guns, with some limited regulation changes, plus funding for mental health crisis treatment and school security. We'll find out what's on the table, and you can join in with your thoughts. And we'll head to the movies. The new Top Gun movie did well at the box office after a couple of big superhero movies did, too. Are people ready to head back to the theaters in large numbers? Are you? We'll get the latest. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.